Good day, everyone, and welcome to today's briefing with Commonwealth Fund. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, you will have the opportunity to ask questions during the question and answer session. You may register to ask a question at any time by pressing the star and one on your touch-tone phone. Please note this call may be recorded, and I will be standing by should you need any assistance. It is now my pleasure to turn the conference over to Rachel Newsom. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon. Thank you for joining us today for our briefing, Unequal Impact, an examination of how COVID-19 has widened inequities for Black and Latino Americans, and what steps can be taken now to address the inequities. I am Rachel Newsom, Vice President for Federal and State Health Policy at the Commonwealth Fund. For those of you who don't know, the Commonwealth Fund is a nonpartisan health policy research foundation aimed at creating a high-performing U.S. health system. All resources from our discussion today and from earlier teleconferences can be found at the Fund's COVID-19 resource page on our website. I am joined today by expert Sarah Bleich, Professor of Public Health Policy at the Harvard Chan School of Public Health, Sonia Diaz, Founding Executive Director of the UCLA Latino Policy and Politics Initiative, Yafet Gadatow, Program Associate, Healthcare Delivery System Reform at the Commonwealth Fund, and Dr. Lori Zephrin, Vice President of Delivery System Reform at the Commonwealth Fund. We are thrilled that you have joined us today, and we thank you for the work that you're doing on this critical issue. 7 months into the U.S. battle with the COVID-19 pandemic, with over 850,000 lives lost across the globe and over 200,000 American lives lost to the pandemic. We can see that the economic devastation is even far more reaching than the cases themselves, with repercussions being felt in every country and every community around the world. Millions more people across the globe are falling below the poverty line, and the measure of extreme poverty was up for the first few months of COVID-19, reversing a 20-year trend. In the U.S. Black and Latino populations, women and people with lower incomes have faced greater hardships attributed to the pandemic. While this trend is alarming and demands attention and focused solutions, we shouldn't be surprised. The longstanding inequities in our health system have been well documented, yet with little to no action to address the systemic racism behind the inequitable outcomes, the outcomes are predictable, unjust, and unacceptable. A global pandemic and demands for racial justice are colliding in 2020 and demanding not only our attention, but also our action. Our conversation today is but one step on this path of dismantling a system designed to produce inequitable outcomes. The experts joining us today will help identify actions that can be taken now to address inequities in the health system, and we're so grateful for their time and expertise today, and for all of you who have chosen to join us. As a reminder, we'll take questions after the formal remarks, but you can enter the queue now for questions by pressing star one. We'll start our conversation today with findings from a new Commonwealth Fund brief by Yafet Gadatow and Dr. Lori Zephrin on the disparities in COVID-19 effects on mental health and economic challenges, where we see the inequities and the areas where policy can make a difference. So with that, I'll turn it over to Yafet.
Great. Thank you, Rachel, and thank you to everyone for joining today. If you have the slides in front of you, you can follow along as I talk. If not, I'm going to be just highlighting some key results from the report. So let's start with slide two. It has been no secret, obviously, that the pandemic has led to massive economic challenges for people across the United States. However, our survey shows that while the economic problems are widespread, Black and Latino people are disproportionately experiencing them. This survey finds that more than half of Latino and nearly half of Black Americans say they are struggling financially because of the pandemic. This includes having to use up most, if not all, of their savings, being unable to pay for basic necessities such as food or rent, or having to have borrowed money to just make ends meet. And the percentage of Black and Latino people who have experienced at least one of these challenges is more than twice that of white respondents. And now if you look to slide three, we see that similar to our survey findings regarding this economic toll of the virus, there has been a significant mental health toll. In fact, one third of all respondents report mental health concerns such as stress and anxiety since the beginning of the pandemic. Adults from households that had a below average income, women and Black and Latino people were most at risk of pandemic-related anxiety and stress. For example, people with lower incomes reported mental health concerns at the highest rate, 44%, nearly 20 points more than people with higher incomes. And this is consistent with other national survey data from the CDC, which show that during the pandemic, there have been rising mental health concerns overall and continued significant disparities. And if you look to slide four now, you'll see how all of this and more has translated into Americans' perceptions of how the virus has been handled. Data shown from another recent Commonwealth Fund publication compares Americans' opinions of their national leaders' handling of the pandemic to eight other high-income countries. And what you'll see is that Americans are less likely to think that their president has done a good or very good job responding to the pandemic than residents of any of these other countries. In fact, only one-third of Americans overall thought so. On slide five, we see how these opinions are broken down by race and ethnicity from our survey. Firstly, we see that white, Latino, and Black people all have overwhelmingly positive views of how hospitals, doctors, and nurses have done in addressing the pandemic. More than 8 out of every 10 respondents say they have done a good or very good job. Secondly, however, these numbers quickly decrease for all three groups when asked about state and local government leaders and the president. And our survey finds that Black people hold the least favorable views of government leaders' responses at both of these levels. And now I'd like to bring in Dr. Lori Zephrin to talk about some of the implications of this.
Great. Thanks so much, Yafet. And so really to just put the findings and also some additional perspective and implications, what we're witnessing today are deep-seated inequities that have existed for years, and they predate the pandemic, but really the pandemic has shined a light on how these deep-seated inequities play out in people's day-to-day lives. Running through savings, struggling with anxiety and depression, we see that communities of color have been hardest hit, and this touches on systemic failures. There has to be assurance that resources designated to provide COVID-19 relief get to the people and the communities that need them most. Our Commonwealth Fund survey really indicates that large numbers of Black and Latino adults, as well as people with low income and women, are struggling to pay for necessities and experiencing mental health concerns related to COVID-19. There is this interrelatedness of economic hardship and mental health impacts, and there are practical things that can make a difference in people's lives. Public policy can help support people by getting them the help that they need. Mental health treatment in this country is still very stigmatized with limited access, and all of this is happening with a patchwork of limited coverage. Such findings call for greater investment in the economic security of these disproportionately affected groups, including rent relief, nutrition assistance programs, and expanded access to behavioral health care. We also need better publicly reported data, not only on testing and treatment and outcomes, by race and ethnicity, gender, language, zip code, requiring the collection and reporting of this data is imperative. And particular attention has to focus on the lasting economic impacts of this crisis on communities of color and the implications for their health. Finally, the low approval ratings regarding the handling of the pandemic among all Americans by state and local government leaders and the president, particularly among Black people, may speak to issues with trust in future policies and initiatives that need to be addressed. You know, trust is truly integral to successful policy, and there are critical discussions that need to be had around trust. Rachel, I'll turn it back to you.
Thanks so much, Lori, and thank you, Yafet, for the overview of the research and the findings. Now we're going to turn to Sonia Diaz to address how COVID-19 has exacerbated health and economic disparities among Latino communities, and steps that policymakers and communities can take now to address the needs. Sonia?
Thank you all for joining us for a discussion about the impact of this pandemic on Black and Latino Americans. I'm Sonia Diaz, founding director of the UCLA Latino Policy and Politics Initiative. The coronavirus pandemic has magnified the racial and ethnic health and wealth disparities that our nation has been grappling with for years. Today, policymakers have a clear choice: architect a successful recovery by centering relief on the community suffering the most harm, or replicate ineffective decisions that further endanger our future workforce. Communities of color have the most to lose in navigating our suboptimal system and worsening economic inequalities. This was true before COVID-19 uprooted life as we know it. As Americans are introduced to telehealth as a result of the coronavirus pandemic, too many Black and Brown communities have struggled to speak with a physician because of a shortage of healthcare workers, language access issues, and the digital divide. This is even more true of behavioral health, which supports the survey's mental health finding. Severe barriers to health access and a shortage of healthcare workers who can meet the needs of our nation's diverse communities predates COVID-19 and only supports the need to double down investments on improving our healthcare system that centers on the needs of underserved communities first. The actions our national and state leaders take during this pandemic are critical to ensure the health and safety of all Americans and to truly ensure our country is on a path for reopening and economic recovery. Black and Brown communities are among the nation's most vulnerable residents, from the ability to access quality to weathering economic downturns. Latinos, in particular, are one of the fastest growing and youthful groups in the country. They fuel our economy with their high workforce participation and are critical to the nation's recovery and future growth. Now, what we know about COVID-19 is that Black and Brown workers have suffered disparate racial impacts during the pandemic. This is due in part because they're concentrated in frontline essential jobs that are not only keeping America open, but keeping those that are able to telework comfortable. And this comes at the highest cost, their health, that of their families, and that of their communities. To ensure we're able to recover, policymakers must take action now to protect the health and preserve the wealth of Black and Brown communities. This means ensuring COVID relief and recovery does not continue to exclude frontline workers. The CARES Act exclusion of mixed status families from the individual rebate relief cost the American economy $10 billion and over 80,000 jobs. Leading with exclusion is going to leave this country further behind. The path forward is clear. We need a healthy and skilled workforce to drive recovery and care for our aging population, whose Social Security and Medicare benefits depend on the wages of young workers of color. Policymakers should consider reforms that center on the needs of Black and Brown communities as the safest bet for keeping this nation healthy and economically viable. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Sonia. We'll now turn to Dr. Sarah Bleich to discuss how COVID-19 has brought longstanding inequities in health outcomes, economic and food insecurity, and challenges in the mental health space to light, especially in communities of color. Dr. Bleich?
Thanks so much, Rachel. I know all you're very familiar with the numbers when it comes to COVID-19, but I do just want to underline the fact that as we think about Black Americans and the pandemic, they're more than three times more likely than white Americans to contract COVID-19 and about twice as likely to die. And there are some counties around the country where Black residents, where there's a high majority, have about six times the death rate compared to counties that are predominantly white. And so, you know, what COVID-19 has done, and you heard Sonia allude to this, is that there are massive health disparities that existed prior to the pandemic, and those have really been ratcheted up and highlighted as a result of the pandemic. And the health disparities that we're seeing are really reflecting two key patterns of inequality. The first is that both Black and Brown minority communities are more likely to live in urban areas. They work in higher risk environments. And the second, from a public health standpoint, is that racial minorities have much higher rates of chronic medical conditions. These are things like obesity, diabetes, kidney disease. And these inequities are standing to long-standing barriers related to access to food, transportation, housing, mental health, and also systemic racism, which has come to the front of the policy conversations in the past few months. And I just want to underline some of the basic challenges that we're seeing right now around food. And you can think of that as food insecurity, that's lack of consistent access to nutritious food. We know that as a result of the pandemic, food insecurity is elevated all across the country. And it's about doubled among the general population from about 11% to about 23, 24%. prior to the pandemic starting, food insecurity was already higher among Black Americans. And now it's the case that about 1 in 3 Black Americans are reporting food insecurity. So 1 in 3 are lacking reliable access to food. And we're seeing some of the highest rates among Black households with children. The question is, you know, what do we do about this? You know, specific to COVID, what's very clear is that we need more equitable testing and tracing, which means that we need to provide populations at highest risk with access to these services first. That includes racial and ethnic minorities. That includes racial and ethnic minorities who also happen to have underlying medical conditions. You heard from Sonia about people who live in very crowded living situations where you cannot physically distance. You need to have better testing and tracing, and also the essential frontline workers who you also heard from Sonia. When it comes to vaccine rollout, it's going to also be important to prioritize these groups because the vaccine cannot go to everyone at once. So you have to pick and choose which groups are going to go first. In the path to making progress, there's also a really important role that Congress has to play. And so in the news right now is the HEROES Bill, which was passed by the Democrats back in the spring, $3.4 trillion. It was not taken up by the Senate. The Republicans passed the HEALS Bill, which is a $1 trillion bill. And there's a lot of space between them. They both include stimulus checks, but they're very different sizes. The White House indicated they will go up a bit. The Democrats and the House have indicated they will go down. But despite that willingness to compromise, there's still a lot of space. And the Democrats have said they won't go to recess, but on October 2nd, there's supposed to be a recess. So the hope is that this bill gets decided by October 1st. Specific in the HEROES Bill is a in the House version, would be an increase to the size of the SNAP benefit. SNAP, as you well know, helps low-income families afford food. Prior to the pandemic, it helped about 38 million households, half of them children, afford food each month. And that number has gone up substantially as a result of the pandemic. And so a 15% increase in the size of the benefit, which would increase the benefit by about $100 per month for a family of four, could go a long way in addressing one key problem right now, which is food insecurity. And I would say a final piece where progress can be made in very meaningful ways is thinking about, you know, how do we meaningfully address access to care? We know that Black populations have lower access to care, and so better investment in community health centers, which are see a disproportionate share of low-income Black patients, can be a really important way forward. And I'll stop there.
Thank you so much, Dr. Bleich. This is another reminder that we are moving to the question and answer period. Please press star one if you would like to enter the queue to ask a question. I was struck by the food insecurity point that you made, Dr. Bleich, and would love to hear from Sonia as well. Are you seeing these same trends in terms of food insecurity? We've heard reports that food banks are also experiencing tremendous demand, and how is that playing out in the communities that you are working with?
Should I go ahead and take that question first?
Sure, go ahead, thank you.
So what we're seeing, certainly it's the case that food banks are being completely oversubscribed, and so there have been reports in the news about miles-long lines to get access to food banks. Food banks were really maximized prior to COVID-19 starting, and they're at a point now where they're completely over capacity. A key way that children are getting food right now is through school, through the National School Lunch Program and Breakfast Program. And prior to the start of COVID, for a typical child, about half of their calories or two-thirds of their calories might come from school. And so all these various safety net programs, or in the case of charitable food, programs that wrap around the food system are either not as accessible as they were, or there simply isn't enough capacity for people to get food. And so this piece about food has really become a major issue in a lot of communities. And a lot of the safeguards that were put in place with past stimulus bills are in the process of expiring. And so families really do need help. And this is where Congress has a really important role to play in helping families simply afford food either through nutrition assistance programs or through the extension of the stimulus check.
Great, thank you so much. Dr. Bleich or Lori or Yaffet, is there anything else you wanted to add on that food insecurity point?
No, I think Sarah captured it. So. really well.
Great. Great. Okay. For our audience members, this is your turn to join the conversation. So this is your opportunity to enter your questions now. We will take your questions now. You can press star one to be entered into the question queue. I would love to start us out while the questions are forming in the queue. We referenced the findings around trust and the implications around vaccine rollout and the need to do that in an equitable manner and prioritizing high need groups. At the same time, we see higher levels of distrust among those groups. So I'd love to hear from our panelists what we should be doing now in our hardest impacted communities to really start having those conversations about vaccines. What partners should we be involving? How can we position ourselves so that when we do have a vaccine that's safe and effective and ready to be rolled out, that we're able to do that in the most effective way. Sonia, do you want to start? And then we'll just have all of our panelists touch on that if they're able. Dr. Bleich, we may have lost Sonia for a moment. Would you like to start us out on the vaccine question?
Yeah, sure. One of the things, and I think there's going to be some need for the same community. And that's going to be written by
Dr. Blake, I'm so sorry to interrupt you. I am having a hard time hearing you. I'm not sure if we're having a technical issue with your line. Lori, why don't you start, and we'll see if it's a if it's isolated to Dr. Blake's line, and if so, we'll figure out what to do next. I'm sorry for the interruption.
Sure, I'm happy to get started. You know, when we look at our survey findings there, you know, we often get some questions around the trust piece, because with the low approval ratings regarding the handling of the pandemic, we see that among all Americans by state and local government leaders and the president, strictly among Black people as well. And so I mentioned earlier this could speak to issues of trust in future policies and initiatives. And so if we're thinking about, as we think about an upcoming vaccine, there's a significant role of trust to really have people feel comfortable and want to move forward with the vaccine. The findings that we see just around the low approval ratings aren't incredibly surprising given people's experience with the pandemic. One of the things we also saw in our survey is that what's really interesting is the international findings about how Americans are less likely than people in other countries to have a positive opinion of the government's response. But we did see a high level of trust between communities and healthcare providers, even though there was a high level of distrust between people of color and federal and state government. So trust in public institutions is important, and institutions need to engender that trust. And there needs to be a responsibility of our public institutions, our federal government, to really work with communities to build that trust in preparation for a potential future vaccine.
Great, thank you.
Question, as a reminder, that is star and one. You may withdraw your question at any time by pressing the pound key. And we will take our first question from Molly Hart with Columbia Missourian. Please go ahead.
Hi. I just had a question for the panel. In talking about the trust in future policies and initiatives, and as one of the presenters was talking about, that there seems to be more trust in healthcare institutions than there would be in federal and state local government. I'm just wondering how you guys have seen the conversations this summer around a mistrust in law enforcement, how you've heard that might play into a future vaccine distribution, and kind of what public health workers can be doing now to ensure the trust of their communities?
Thank you for that question. That's where I was trying to get us before we had some technical difficulties. So Sonia, do you want to start and then we'll move over to Sarah?
Yeah, one of the things I think is really important for Latino Americans in particular is the trusted messenger. And we know that those are doctors and healthcare workers, teachers and family members, celebrities, and it's definitely not politicians. One of the things that's really important is that there's widespread misinformation. That's something that is expressly focused on suppressing not only civic engagement, but access to important programs. And that's part of the policies that we've seen out of the White House with public charge and attacks on Latino communities. For vaccine, it's really important to ensure that any sort of rollout, along with just emergency preparedness, has culturally and linguistically competent contours. And this is an investment that policymakers can make. It does not have to be the sole decision or discretion of Congress. Local, municipal, and state elected officials have a role in disseminating accurate information and ensuring that vaccine access is actually available to the people that need it most. We saw this with COVID-19 testing and the fact that many workers at meatpacking plants and agricultural labor fields did not have access to testing, and it's really important that you have actors, including local and municipal actors, that are being able to disseminate this. Trusted partners for the Latino community will always include community clinics and state hospitals, so that's also something for policymakers to consider.
Great. Dr. Bush?
Thanks. I hope you can hear me okay now. So, Molly, to your question about from the context of Black Americans, we've already heard that, you know, trust in state and federal government is somewhat low. You've mentioned this issue around trust in law enforcement. And so I would really underline what Sonia was saying about really thinking about how do we do proper communication at a hyper-local level to leverage trusted members in the community to help people understand both how important the vaccine is for them and that it's safe and it's effective. And I think there's quite a steep hill to climb when it comes to this, particularly in communities that have been disproportionately impacted by law enforcement in negative ways. There is a real distrust in government officials in general. But that said, similar to Sonia's point about who's trusted within Latinx communities, it's similar among Black communities. There are members who, if they are the ones rolling out the message and doing effective communication, I think that can go a long way in trying to compel people to do something that is in their best interest from a public health standpoint.
Great. Lori, is there anything you'd want to add on this point?
Yeah, I think it's very challenging because there's a need for expediency, right, as the pandemic moves on. And so when one thinks of a strategy to roll out the vaccine, then the strategy is to, you know, highlight and prioritize those that need it the most. And as we see, communities of color are the ones most impacted, so one would intuitively want to focus in on those communities. However, we also have to ensure that the time is taken to build that trust, because this lack of trust in public institutions, it didn't start only with the pandemic. This is prior to the pandemic. So there's this combination of taking the time to build that trust and really going deep, as Sarah had mentioned and Sonia had mentioned, into the communities and really understanding why that distrust exists. And then also it's thinking and combining through building the infrastructure around vaccine, leveraging communities, and also building the infrastructure around testing and keeping track of outcomes, because the way public institutions build trust is by showing that they care about communities that are most affected. And I think that can be done by building the infrastructure and providing the resources that are needed to keep communities safe and really get communities healthier and who have been suffering from this pandemic.
And I think we're ready for the next question in the queue.
Perfect. We'll move next to Holiday Nolan from Office of Senator Wyden. Please go ahead.
I think that's me. My name is Naladai Nalam, and my question was in regards to the comment made previously about needing better investment in community health programs and organizations. I live in Portland, Oregon, and I know of a few immigrant and refugee-based organizations that are doing their best to implement contact tracing programs within those communities. Are investments for these types of organizations included in any of these COVID stimulus packages? And if so, if not, what are some other ways to get investment into these programs?
Tony, do you want to start?
I think one of the most important things is that state and local elected officials have widespread discretion in how they allocate their own funds and then funds that they receive from the federal government. And this is exactly the place where there should be a double down investment on viable community institutions that service marginalized populations that are on the front lines. And that includes immigrants and refugees, workers, that are really doing the hard work and putting their lives and the lives of communities at risk. It's important to note that there are instances of this pre-COVID. So in California, for example, in dealing with the unaccompanied minors and access to justice, there was a policy at the state level to ensure that immigrant rights groups had money, state grants and contracts to provide legal service and access to justice to immigrant Californians. This is true in the healthcare context in particular. One of the things that I think is really important for state and local governments is to ensure that they have to counteract all of the fear around accessing important services. This is not just health and social safety net services, but really services that are important for the economic viability of a household, including a moratorium on eviction. So making sure that policymakers are thinking about these communities, centering relief on that, that does not only include appropriations, but it also includes the money necessary to get the message down to these people. For Latinos in particular, they rely in terms of the digital nexus on their smartphones. That's how they access the internet more than any other medium. So ensuring that there's text messages or phone calls or digital kind of interactions is really important. I think the other thing that is really important is recognizing that information cannot only be distributed in English. And for some language minorities, including some of the indigenous populations, Spanish is not sufficient. So all of these are things that policymakers should be keeping a keen eye on.
Great, thank you. Dr. Blash, would you like to add anything on this point?
Sure, thanks, Rachel. So we mentioned briefly that the HEROES Bill has passed in the House and was not taken up by the Senate, but what was included in that bill was tens of billions of dollars to help with testing and tracing. And so the challenge, obviously, is that has not passed and all that money was not included in the Senate version. So what's happened in the absence of that support from the federal government is that state and local governments are just having to step up and as a result are facing enormous resource gaps. And so if you look across the country, what it creates is a real patchwork approach to testing and tracing because it's very much limited by the resources that state and local governments can bring to bear.
Right, right. Thank you. One of the findings that was so striking was around the mental health findings that a third of all respondents indicated mental health challenges during the COVID-19 period. And both Dr. Blaish and Sonia spoke to the stigma and the difficulties in an appropriate number of providers to serve these communities well. Sonia, you laid out a few ideas on how to address this, but I would love to hear thoughts from all of the panelists on what can we do right now to kind of mobilize and meet some of the mental health needs of these communities, and then what's a longer-term plan to really build up the mental health profession and support system to really be able to take care of these communities longer-term. Lori, do you want to start with some of the mental health findings and thoughts on what would be a good start at this point?
Yeah,
Sure, happy to. Sorry, let me. Yeah, sure. So with, you know, our survey, we did, you know, it did highlight just the number of people experiencing mental health concerns relating to COVID-19. And really that just shows the impact of just the stress and anxiety relating to COVID-19, but also the interrelatedness of the economic hardship and mental health impacts. As I mentioned, you know, earlier, you know, mental health treatment in this country is very stigmatized, there's limited access. All this is happening with a patchwork of limited coverage status. You know, in addition to that, fears relating to going to healthcare systems, relating to potential immigration status or other status. And so there's really importance for significant investment in mental health care. You know, some of the work that just we've done more generally has really spoken to the integration of mental health into primary health care and how that is needed and really important. And also one of the other things we also need to highlight is just investment in mental health providers and also investment in the diversity of mental health providers that can respond to the trauma that communities of color have experienced and are heightened during this time of crisis.
Great. Sonia, do you want to speak to the mental health challenges?
Yes, this is an important issue in the Latino community. We've seen a lot of research as of late of young Latina teenagers and suicide and depression and anxiety. COVID-19 has only exacerbated issues facing Latino families. There's huge issues with access to behavioral health care. This is due in large part to the lack of language and ethnic concordance amongst our healthcare workers that are dealing with mental health. We simply, akin to physicians, do not have a diverse and linguistically competent mental health care workforce in this country. In a place like California, our behavioral health care capacity to serve the state's plurality population, which is Latinos, is severely divested from. We do not have enough physicians that speak Spanish and want to actually pursue this type of care in these communities. This is where COVID has really put a spotlight on telehealth. I think more Americans than usual are now relying on telehealth because that is the directive from providers. Now, for many marginalized communities that are medically underserved, this is what they did. They had only telehealth because there was a lack of doctors in their area. This is true in places like Texas and Florida. States have responded by increasing the amount of residencies, also increasing training and capacity. COVID shows us that we need to double down our investment on our healthcare workforce. We need to ensure that we do not have a shortage, but I think the money needs to also influence a need to have more diverse healthcare practitioners and mental health specialists that will work in underserved communities. And that is a place where we could really use some government funding to incentivize this practice.
Thank you so much. Dr. Bush?
Thanks. So to build on the points that Lori and Sonia made about the importance of leveraging telehealth and diversifying mental health specialists, I would add that particularly for Black communities, there's the COVID-19 pandemic, but that's also happening in parallel with all the protests around police brutality. And that just adds an extra layer of stress and anxiety, which frankly makes it hard. And then you compound that with job loss and income insecurity. And so it just becomes a very hard time. I think one practical way forward is to think about the fact that COVID-19 cases, which is obviously a minority of mental health problems, but COVID-19 cases are primarily being identified and treated in healthcare settings by workers who have no mental health training. So thinking about how do we incorporate the assessment and intervention for mental health concerns in those settings is going to be important, and generally integrating mental health within all the telehealth interactions that people are having recently, because so much of the shift of healthcare has gone to telehealth, can be a really low-hanging fruit way of getting to people and just trying to understand the types of issues that they're grappling with and ideally offering some concrete solutions.
Thank you. We'll turn to our next question in the queue.
Jocelyn Cabrera from Cronk Night News. Please go ahead.
Hi, can everyone hear me okay?
you can. Thank you.
Okay, so my name is Joycelyn Cabrera. I'm a reporter with Cronkite News at Arizona PBS. And I'm wondering if any of this data can be broken down by individual states or cities. Are there any states or cities that are outliers with these issues surrounding health in Latino and Black communities that stand out from the rest of the nation as an average?
Lori, I'm going to have you address this first, both the what this survey is able to tell us, but what some of our other research has shown in terms of looking at communities and zip codes. So I will turn this over to you first.
Sure. So for this survey, we did not dive into regions for this particular survey. We did actually, for this survey, we actually do have comparisons between the United States and other high-income countries, and happy to share that information with you. I spoke a little bit about it in terms of the approval rating, so to speak, of pandemic response at the government level. We have, a few months ago, we did do a look at communities that have higher concentration or percentage of Black people compared to not, and we did that by county, and just did show a higher impact of COVID-19 deaths than over higher impact of COVID-19 diagnoses in communities that just by percentage had higher than average number of Black people, and so that's really the data that we've done by community level. But to your point around community level data, that is truly critical. We need better publicly reported data. We need it at the zip code level. We need it by race, ethnicity, gender, and language. And requiring the collection and reporting of the data is an imperative. And particularly moving forward, we need to better understand the lasting economic impact of this crisis on communities that are most affected. It's really important. There's also also, just for the Commonwealth Fund, our state scorecard has recently been released, and also happy to share that as well. That also provides state-by-state information on some key indicators that that really provide a sense of how states are performing on key health indicators prior to COVID and the potential implications for a response to COVID-19.
Thank you. Yeah, I did see the state scorecard, so I'll take another.
Yeah, and Jocelyn, to quickly say, we don't have the data from this survey broken down by state because the sample size wasn't large enough to break it down by every state and territory. However, we were able to do it by region, and in the report, in the appendix, we had that information broken down by Northeast, South, Midwest, and West, and we actually didn't find significant differences by region for the economic or mental health indicators. So that's why they weren't higher up in the report.
Okay, thank you.
Take our last question from Michelle Merrill with Atlanta Magazine. Please go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call, my question. I know there was some conversation about trust and vaccination, and I just wanted to sort of circle back to that. And, you know, overall, the lack of trust, I was wondering what effect that may have on the willingness of people to get a vaccine, and particularly given that people of color are disproportionately affected by COVID. If they don't get vaccinated, then that's, you know, another risk for them. So healing that trust issue would seem especially important in that in those communities.
Thank you so much for the question. Dr. Blyce, would you like to start us off?
Yeah, so I think you're spot on that erosion of trust has big implications for who will and will not take or accept a COVID vaccine. I think that there's a number of polls about this, and I think there was one recently which said that about 6 in 10 people would get a COVID vaccine, which was down from July. I don't know the breakdown by race, but I think your broader point is, if it's the case that trust is lower among, say, Black and Latin populations, and those are also groups who are at higher risk for both COVID-19, but then all various adverse health outcomes that we've already talked about, then that has big implications for persistent disparities. And so I think this circles back to the conversation we were having about some of the things that will need to happen in the short term to try to build up public trust, ideally in the institutions that will provide these vaccines, by using trusted members of the community to try to close that gap in terms of people who feel as if they can't safely take the vaccine, by helping them understand that they can and they should for their own safety.
Great. Sonia?
I wanted to say that this tracks with some of the polling initially at the onset of COVID-19. 86% of Latinos that were surveyed by Latino Decisions in SOMOS, which is a healthcare community clinic in New York, said they were very concerned that local hospitals wouldn't have enough supplies to treat the pandemic. They also are really concerned as to whether or not they're going to be able to afford it. And with the vaccine, a lot of the interest in trusted messaging cannot be understated, because we know in Los Angeles, for instance, there is free testing, as with other jurisdictions. That doesn't negate the fact that people still have fear in the community as to what are the economic consequences or collateral consequences. These are ways that trusted messengers and the investment in those messengers can really go a long way. The pandemic is very unique because it affects everybody. So any sense of continuing the trajectory where Black and Latino communities and Native Hawaiian and Pacific Islanders as well, and the indigenous communities, are disproportionately affected is really going to make it hard to recover and to reopen. These are the workers that are essential to recovery, but also are the future workforce of this country, and they need to be healthy. And we're seeing that with younger Blacks and younger Latinos across the country, their COVID-19 infection and mortality is dissimilar to that of white Americans when you adjust for age. So in terms of the vaccine, it's important that the vaccine is safe. I also want to, just given the news recently this week, is point out there are reasons that Black and brown communities distrust medicine, and in some ways are reticent to be the first because of the guinea pig interventions that have occurred throughout this country's history. Whether it's Tuskegee or the forced sterilization of Chicanas in Los Angeles County, to the news this week about what's happening in our immigration detention centers to women and hysterectomies. All of this does not help ensure that people know that when they access care, including a vaccine that is so necessary, that they, in fact, will have positive health outcomes. So we really need to rely on trusted messaging and counteract misinformation and do our due diligence so that people are not harmed based on racial animus.
Great. Thank you so much, Sonia. I have I'm just going to ask folks, we're nearing the end. I want to make sure that if anyone in the audience has other questions, that you take the opportunity to press star one now and enter the queue. And I have a question while we wait for the final questions to queue up. All of our panelists spoke to the importance of data and the ability to see cases as well as deaths, as well as community need by race and ethnicity. And I'm just wondering if all of you could touch on kind of this tension between the need to collect accurate, really timely data that can be acted on by policymakers at the federal, state, and local level. How does that interact with the trust issues we've just been talking about? Seems really critical, Sonia, especially in some of the mixed status families or in those communities that you were talking about. There is such a fear. How do we reconcile that need for data with and also very real concern around what some of those data sharing opportunities might mean for folks?
Well, I mean, this is Lori Zephron. I can start just in terms of the need for data. You know, we do need better publicly reported data. You know, very early in the pandemic, there was limited data, and with more data, we had a better sense of the disparities and who is affected the most. You know, as we move forward to this next phase of the pandemic and think through vaccination and other aspects of treatment, we also need data on the impacts of that. And so we really have to be, it's really important to ensure that we continue to build our data capacity so that we can monitor who gets testing, who gets treatment, who gets vaccinations, and what are the outcomes. And also, the data also has to incorporate the lasting economic impacts of this crisis on communities of color, as well as the implications for their short and long-term health.
And I would piggyback on that to say that, you know, certainly it's the case, I completely agree with Lori, that data is king when it comes to understanding the problem. But if we also care about its intersection with trust, then once we know where the problem is and we know who is at highest risk, then it is on policymakers to actually do something about it. And I think part of where some of the tension has been recently is that we have very good evidence now about the disproportionate impact of COVID-19 in terms of death and infection among Black and Latinx populations. But it is not always the case that they're getting the best testing and the best tracing and the best support from public policy. And so it's a cyclical process of using data to inform policy in a way that really tries to address the problems that we're uncovering, and then using the data to identify more problems, and then use the data to create solutions.
That's great. Sonia, is there anything you want to add on that point?
No.
Great, thank you. We are very close to the end of our session and our time together. I want to give our panelists the opportunity to make a final remark if they choose to. I just want to take this opportunity to thank our panelists for joining us, to thank our attendees for joining us, and to remind you that the slides that Yafet and Lori referenced are on the teleconference page. All of the Commonwealth Fund COVID-19 resources you can find on our website. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Blech for any closing comments.
Thanks, Rachel. So the one point that I would say is we haven't really touched on the election, but one big issue around trust and vaccine rollout in the election is the level of trust that the general Black population has for President Trump versus Vice President Biden. And what we know is that Black respondents have, or Black individuals have, one of the lowest levels of trust in the president, and they have much higher levels of trust in Joe Biden. And so that just has big implications for, depending on who's elected, it may really change trust in vaccines when it eventually rolls out.
Thank you. Sonia, any closing remarks on your end?
No, I just want to say that it's similar in the Latino community. One of the most important issues for Latino voters over the course of the last 4 years has been access to quality and affordable health care, followed by jobs in the economy, and as of late, COVID-19 response. So these are issues that are paramount to Latinos, and they need to be addressed from the Latino lens by all parties and candidates in the election, but also by state and local officials for these down ballot races. This is also happening at a time where we've had a very politically inept U.S. census that impacts our data analysis as social scientists and in thinking about trends and forecasting, but also in appropriating precious resources that we know center on the needs of these communities. So we're at a place right now to really decide how this country seeks to recover. Does it seek to rebound on the backs of essential and frontline workers while leaving them out from important relief and recovery? Or do we want to center resources on those that have really borne the brunt of this pandemic and failed systems? And I think the latter is the place where we can really thrive, not only as a country, but as a democracy.
Thank you so much. And finally, I'll turn it over to Yafet and to Lori for your final thoughts.
Yeah, the point that I just really want to reiterate that has been said is just that the importance of data, like we are able to quantify these effects on Black and Latino populations, on women, on low-income people in this survey because we asked for it, right? And because we the investment into analyzing the data this way. And that just needs to continue to be the norm in research. It needs to be the norm for policymakers and in government. It's just critically important to understand what is happening to these populations and how we can best address it. Thank you.
Hey, thanks, Yafit, and thanks, Sarah and Sonia. Really, I'd just like to say, you know, we know that people in this country have very different experiences based on a number of factors, including their race, their gender, where they live, how much money they make. And, you know, in terms of what needs to happen, we need to take the steps. We have to take the steps needed to get this pandemic under control. And by utilizing the data, we have to assure that the resources designated to provide COVID-19 relief get to people and the communities that need them the most. You know, the social and economic disruption that we're seeing secondary to COVID-19 is affecting specific communities, and it's going to be a critical component of knowing where these communities are, and we know where they are, and really allocating resources for their recovery efforts and really understanding the long-term impact on economic and health outcomes so that we can continue to ensure that the resources are there.
Thank you so much, Lori. And I think that's a great place to end. Again, thanks to our panelists. Thanks to all of you for joining us today. You can find the recording as well as all of the resources on our website. Thanks so much and have a great afternoon.